Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We are back at State Fair, which either means I just ate a lot or I'm about to eat a lot. Don Moeller is here, and the Senator is here, who hasn't eaten a lot yet, but we hope to feed you some chicken and waffles is what I would go with. Senator Ben Cardin is our guest here on Baltimore Positive today, and we've waited to have you. And every time we have someone really important and influential here, there's like something going on in the news that we want to react to right away.
What's going on?
When Dutch came, when Chris Van Hollen, we didn't have to talk about impeachment. And I guess we could start or end with that, but that was not what this was about.
Well, you know, whatever you schedule, it's going to be something going on, you know, and particularly with this administration, every morning is an adventure with the president with his tweets. So it's a time you got to be prepared.
Well, but before we jump into the national scene, which could take hours to talk about, I want to talk a little bit, Senator. You are, without a doubt, not just to flatter you because you're sitting here, you're one of the most distinguished lawmakers in the history of Maryland politics. You've been at this for over 50 years, and you've been successful. You've never lost an election. You win by huge margins. You're incredibly respected. I want you to take us back. We like to ask our guests, take us back to the beginning. How does the son of Dora and Meyer Cardin, growing up in Baltimore, what lessons did you learn? What was your household like, and how does that contribute to who you became, this dedicated public servant?
Don, first of all, thank you. And thank you for your public service your incredible career helping the people of Baltimore County and our region. I grew up in a family of public service. My father was active in public service. He was a state legislator, became a circuit court judge, and very active in our community in a lot of different events. My mother was extremely active in a lot of different organizations. So public service was something that we talked about all the time. We have a closely knit family. And the values were very much instilled upon me that we have a responsibility to help our community. So when I started in high school, actually in middle school, I started being involved in student government. So I started at a pretty young age.
So you were running for office at 11, 12, and 13?
Oh, yes.
Did you lose an election there? Did you ever lose an election in middle school?
No, I haven't lost an election, I think, since the ninth grade I've been successful.
But you did lose one in the ninth grade.
I think
it didn't say that on Wikipedia. You better update that.
I think I was not eligible. I think I filed for office. And you had to be an eighth grader or a seventh grader, and I was a sixth grader, and they wouldn't accept mine.
All I see is, like, vote for Pedro. You know what I mean? Like, you know, vote for Ben. You know?
So you got, so it was family, you know, it was a sense of that we give back.
Right. So I was very active in student government at the University of Pittsburgh and really enjoyed it, active in my fraternity, was able to get some things done there. So I went to law school, and I had no intentions of running for public office at that point. I really enjoyed law school, between my second and third year, there was a vacancy in the Maryland General Assembly. My uncle, who had retired 6 months earlier, the election was coming up the next time that he was not on the ballot. So it was an opportunity for me to run while I was still a law student because primarily my last name was well known because of my family. And we didn't know whether other opportunities would present itself. My brother, quite frankly, was an assistant state's attorney. So therefore, he would have to give up his job. I was a student. I didn't have to give up anything. So I decided to run. And the rest, I think, is the story.
How old were you?
I was 22 when I ran.
22.
What did you know about government at 22? And I would think we're at a different time then, right? Like, I mean, Kennedy had just been assassinated, literally, right? I mean, we're the unrest hadn't really happened here. That was kind of a tender time, right?
Right. What I knew about government, first I knew Annapolis was the state capital, so I didn't know that.
Do you know all 50 or just Maryland?
No, just Maryland at the time. I also I knew Harrisburg was the capital of Pennsylvania because I went to the University of Pittsburgh, so I knew that. So I had two of them down. I knew I knew street politics because I grew up in street politics.
So what does that
mean?
That's what I both.
Right. I haven't heard that term since.
Well, I worked polling places since I was 7 years of age. I was working polling places, giving out literature. I attended political meetings with my father at a very young age. So I went to Democratic organizations and civic organizations and talked about how our system worked. How in those days people looked at their political organization as an opportunity not only to participate, but for particularly immigrants, it was a way of getting employment. So I understood the importance of being politically involved so that marginal communities could do better in our community. So I knew that before I started college, because I was part of the political fabric of our community through my father and through my uncle. So I knew a little bit. But did I know what was going to happen in Annapolis? No. My first year as a member of the General Assembly, I was also a law student. So I was commuting between Annapolis and Baltimore, between law school and the legislature.
Ritchie Highway back then, right?
Ritchie Highway.
That was what you had. Right. That's all you had, right?
You know, I think the limitations has run on this. I would attend a 12 o'clock session in the Maryland General Assembly, particularly on Friday, I think it was, and make a 1 o'clock class in downtown Baltimore. Now, obviously...
What was the speed limit? Did they have camera lights back
then? Oh, imagine. That's moving.
They didn't have... they had cameras, the real cameras, and the ones that... Brownie Hawkeye cameras. They had all those cameras back then, yes.
So you're in the General Assembly. You're a 22-year-old freshman. And then before long, you become the youngest Speaker of the House in the history of, I think that's still to this date, the youngest speaker. And how does that happen? Does this young 22-year-old from Baltimore become the youngest speaker in the history of Maryland?
So I could tell you that I worked very hard, I studied, I met everybody, did all the political things, attended everything. But the truth is, you need a little bit of luck in politics. There's no question about it. I got elected with a lot of high-powered freshman members of the House of Delegates. It was a reapportionment redistricting year, and there were 50 or 60 new members of the House of Delegates, including people like Paul Sarbanes. And
That was a time a lot of people, young people, were motivated to become involved in public service, right? Literally.
Steny Hoyer's first year in the Maryland legislature, Wally Erlinsky's first year in the Maryland legislature. And there was a lot of people like that who were very aggressive. And that, again, is a transition year. We're going back to the 1967, and it was a transition year. Marvin Meadell was Speaker of the House. The legislature was somewhat dependent upon the governor, although the governor was not it was Agnew at the time, so there was more independence starting in the General Assembly. But it was still a pretty controlled situation. There was only two major committees in the General Assembly, the Judiciary Committee and Ways and Means Committee. The Ways and Means Committee had the budget of the state. There was no Appropriations Committee back then. And most of the leadership came through the Ways and Means Committee. Marvin Mandel had been chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, and he rose to become Speaker. My first good fortune was that I was in the same district as Marvin Mandel. I was on the same political ticket as Marvin Mandel. So I was elected. I had an opportunity in my first year to go into the Ways and Means Committee, which was a real plum to be able to get onto the Ways and Means Committee. So I had that opportunity because of the district that I came from. My second break was that I really became friendly with a person named Janet Huffman, who was a fiscal genius for Baltimore City. I represented Baltimore City, and I took special interest in the needs of Baltimore City. So I got involved in the finance of the city and what the state could do to help. This is transition time. At that time, Baltimore City had, I think, about 30% of the members of the General Assembly from Baltimore City. It was by far the largest jurisdiction, had all the political strength, but it was starting to lose that. And we really had to be more attentive to the needs of Baltimore. So I suggested having a caucus of the Baltimore City members on the Ways and Means Committee to meet every week. We met every Saturday morning in City Hall with Janet Huffman to plan a fiscal strategy for Baltimore. And from that position, I was able to leverage that to really gain, I think, a reputation in the General Assembly. So by the end of my first term, Thomas Hunter Lowe had become the Speaker as a result of Marvin Mandel becoming governor. And I was able to become the vice chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. So I rose pretty quickly through the ranks, leveraging, again, my position representing Baltimore City's fiscal issues.
So about Baltimore City at that time, we're talking about mid-70s, correct?
Yes.
Just thoughts about where Baltimore was then and your representation of Baltimore, where Baltimore is now, and perception of Baltimore. I see these old videos of then Mayor Schaefer with a little more hair standing out in front of nothing but grass, and sort of the McCormick building was still there. And I always call it, you know, Mickey Mousing it. I call it the, you know, Walt Disney. He saw a picture of a mouse and it turned into Walt Disney World. Mayor Schaefer and his impact and Baltimore in the 1970s and what it's become over 40 years.
So, you know, Don Schaefer was also part of our same political organization. He originally represented me in the city council from the old 5th Councilmatic District. He was our councilman, one of our. So, from that position, when I ran for my first reelection, he was chairman of our reelection committee. So, you know, Don Schaefer was part of our political organization, and we were really good friends. Don Schaefer was a unique individual. I think we all understand that. He understood that what he needed to do for Baltimore is get the most talented people around him, give them the ability to use their creativity, give them the resources so they could get things done, and we could really make progress. And he was extremely successful in doing that. He set up, as you know, these shadow organizations that got a lot of criticisms from the editorial writers of the Baltimore Sun, but it worked. It worked because he really wanted the right thing for Baltimore. He did not abuse the power, but he took power that was not really given to him to get results done.
Now, for folks who may not know, our listeners who may not be steeped in that Baltimore history, Fraser Smith was one of our guests early on, and he talked about the whole world of the shadow governments. And actually, I would say that his take on it, even though he's, you know, been a tough journalist over many years, was the same as yours, that it was easy to criticize those shadow governments, but that in a sense, bringing those businessmen and women together actually helped to get things done.
Oh, absolutely. He was just an incredible person. And his loyalty as mayor of Baltimore was to Baltimore. And he could not understand why not everyone else had that same commitment to Baltimore City. I will always remember when I was Speaker of the House, represented Baltimore City, and we had a transportation bill that was up. And we reviewed the transportation bill, and we had come to raise gasoline taxes, and it divided the money up. And we were absolutely convinced that although we supported more revenue going into transportation, the bill that was before us did not have adequate accountability to make sure that the transportation programs move forward as we need them to. So we came to a leadership decision in the Maryland General Assembly that we would not support the bill at this time. And I had a really difficult conversation with Governor Hughes about it, but he understood where we were coming from, and we were going to hold it off for a year. Well, in comes Don Schaefer. He comes into my office. I had a meeting going on. If you know, the Speaker's office is kind of cramped in the Capitol. I had a meeting going on in my office. He didn't bother waiting for that meeting to end. He came in and said, "I got to talk to you." So I have another ante room. It's the bathroom. So he went, so he went into the bathroom, just the two of us.
Sounds like a Happy Days episode, by the way.
And you could hear the screaming.
Was the Fonz there?
And he said, "Where's your loyalty?" I said, "To the state of Maryland. I'm Speaker of the House." He says, "No, your loyalty is to Baltimore City. This bill gives Baltimore City a big hunk of money. We'll get 25 or 30% of the money, so you waste the other 70%. We're going to get this money. You got to go for it." And I didn't. I didn't go for it. And it was about 6 months had to go by before Don Schaefer would talk to me again.
But and you repaired the relationship.
We repaired the relationship, and we had a ceremony with Janet Huffman where I gave him a toilet seat.
You could do that in those days. Well, there was no Twitter.
Take us back. One of the fascinating things, and you touched on an issue that's near and dear to Nestor's heart, and that is that whoever the mayor ends up being, the concept of getting the best and the brightest. You've observed that, yes, over the years, and the importance of that, and then saying to them, let's be impatient and get
things
done.
Well, I want to add one more thing, because Don says the next mayor of Baltimore needs to have a hatred of incompetence. And I want to ask you, did Mayor Schaefer and then Governor... He hated incompetence.
Oh, yes.
He hated it.
He also was very impatient. He wanted things done yesterday. And, you know, I always remember, I mean, he was a builder. There was no question about it. He wanted to see progress made every day. And one day, I had parked my car in downtown Baltimore, walking to my law office, and I saw Don Schaefer sitting by himself in one of his favorite restaurants. And I walked in, and he was by himself. I said, "Do you want some company?" And I see he was really depressed. And I said, "What's wrong?" He says, "I just did my walk through Baltimore, and we're finished." I said, "What's wrong?" I didn't see a single building being built or crane being up. There's no future. I mean, he always wanted things to be built, new projects, and he would not tolerate people who were incompetent. You're exactly right about that. But he basically embraced good people. I mean, his selections were incredible. Jim Rouse, you know, think about that. You know, Bob Embry and
yeah, legendary names of people who had vision. You know, it's interesting, Senator, you mentioned the lunch that you had and his impatience and being sad. Near the very end of his career, I was fortunate to be with him at a lunch in Little Italy, and he had arrived early. He was punctual, and I arrived a little early. So it was just the two of us, and it was the same, almost the same emotions that you're describing. He was down. Mm-hmm. And we talked to him, and it just was the same. He had been governor, he had been mayor, and he just missed the ability to get things done. That ability to get things done seemed to be his driving force to make things better.
Oh, absolutely. First of all, the system of local government fits him perfectly. When you have a strong mayor and the city council really doesn't have the power that the mayor has. They're not equal branches of government. Whereas in the General Assembly, with a much larger group, with a more independent General Assembly, and with the whole state you have to be concerned about, it wasn't as a comfortable turf for him, for his style, as it was to be mayor. So I think he always enjoyed his years as mayor and recognized that he was really special in that, and was frustrated that he couldn't use the same type of system at the state level.
Now, I know we're coming up on a break, but one of the things before we go to a break, I think back, you were the Speaker of the House, you know, decades ago. You then had a distinguished career in the House of Representatives. Now you're a senator in the United States Senate. I think what people appear so frustrated today by the partisan breakdown and our discourse.
You've been at this a long time.
How has that evolved?
Yeah, there's no question. We've gotten much more partisan as a political system around the country and in Maryland and even in local governments. And, you know, to take you back to the time I was Speaker of the House, I established a leadership structure in the House in order to try to give direction to a legislative agenda during the 90-day session. So our leadership team, which consists of our committee chairman, included the Republican leader. He was part of my leadership team. Now, I did not select the Republican leader. The Republicans selected him. I had Ray Beck and Bobby Neal were Republican leaders during my time as Speaker. But they were always invited into my leadership meetings because there were no surprises. And they knew, come election time, we're going to knock heads. I'm going to try to get as many Democrats elected as possible. But once the election's over, it's in all of our interest to work together and to get things done. And we recognize that by having the input of all of our members, Republicans and Democrats, we're going to pass better bills. And we're going to pass bills that won't be changed every 2 or 4 years. So we knew that lesson early. So Bobby Neal, for example, was one of the brightest fiscal minds I've ever served with. So he helped me develop the capital budget for the state and played a critical role. He helped us deal with the proper relationship between the state of Maryland, the University of Maryland system, the University of Maryland Hospital. He was able to help us develop that relationship. So he knew that what he was doing was accomplishing good things for the people of our state. He was a loyal leader of his party, but recognized his first responsibility is to the people of Maryland as an elected official. That's how we operated. Now, we were always friendly. There were limits. We didn't of course, our political system was different then. We didn't need as much money to be raised. We didn't have as much reliance on special interests and raising money as we do today. So our political system has really changed. As Speaker of the House, I didn't have to raise money to get Democrats elected. They could do that on their own. Today, the Speaker is very
all around the state.
Right. So it's changed, and that's, of course, true when you look at running for the United States Senate or running for Congress. The amount of money that the individual person raises for that race is a small percentage of the total dollars needed to become elected. You need your party support. You need third-party money. All that is now involved in our political system. So it's much more dependent upon the politics to get elected than it was back then. Most of the time then, it was a local. You just had to work your constituency, and you could be elected.
Street politics.
But you're a historian, and I know we have to wrap up this segment. When you look at it, where did we go off the rails? What's contributed to this hyper partisanship, as you said, all the way down to the local level, where the public says a pox on both your houses? What happened? Where did it evolve?
I think that when we could have controlled how elections are run in this country, we did not. The party that's in power always thinks the current system favors them. So the party in power does not want to fundamentally change the way you do elections. And so we had opportunities to try to really reform our system. We had looked at public financing of campaigns. We looked at reasonable restrictions or constitutional amendments so that the First Amendment rights of freedom of speech could allow still the legislatures to control how much money is spent in campaigns. I mean, today, a wealthy person has a much better chance of getting elected than someone without wealth because they can spend unlimited amount of money to be elected. A person who wants to have a great deal of influence in our political system can contribute unlimited sums. So,
all compounded by Citizens United?
Yes. Of course, the Supreme Court did not help. The Supreme Court added to this greatly by saying corporations are citizens and have the rights of citizens under Citizens United. That was, in my view, one of the worst decisions of the Supreme Court. So, when we could have controlled it, we didn't. It got worse and worse. Supreme Court added to it, and now it's out of control. And I say frequently, I don't believe that legislators are corrupt or people who run for office are corrupt. They're working in a corrupt system. The system itself lends itself to unfair considerations because of the need to raise money.
Nestor, you love history lessons.
Well, I want to come back. Uniquely, you've served our citizens in Baltimore, in Annapolis, and also down in D.C. I want to hear about those differences. We have Senator Ben Cardin out today. We are at State Fair. We're eating the chicken, the waffles, the carnivore, the eggs, the bacon, the grits, the shrimp. I've done it all.
I don't think there's a thing on the menu that you haven't
had. This is the high holy season for my religion, so let's keep it kosher if you could.
What? Evan, can you help us?
Grits is okay.
We're back for more Baltimore Positive with Senator Ben Cardin right after this.